In a world of Democrats,
there will be time for them to make profits. Now's not that time.
And Republicans,
I've abandoned free market principles to save the free market system.
You need a voice of liberty. Look no further. You've found it. Tom Woods. Beware, citizen. You are now departing from the world of allowable opinion. The Tom Woods Show.
Welcome to the Tom Woods Show, episode 411. Well, 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 you are in for a treat today because Kevin Gutzman joins us once again. It's always great to talk to Kevin. Kevin is a professor of history at Western Connecticut State University, and we are going to talk about a course that Hillsdale College makes available for free on The Federalist, or sometimes known as The Federalist Papers. And it turns out this course, well, it's not entirely wrong, but there are numerous errors, and of course, there is a kind of an agenda beneath it, the typical Straussian, neoconservative type agenda, and we want to talk about that today. Kevin Gutzman is the author of numerous books, including James Madison and The Making of America, the New York Times best-selling book, The Politically Incorrect Guide to the Constitution, as well as a book with me called Who Killed the Constitution? That book is from 2008. You can check out these titles on the show notes page for today, tomwoods.com/411. We'll also have a link to the Hillsdale course that we're talking about today. Kevin Gutzman, welcome back to the show.
Glad to be here, Tom.
Kevin, I don't know why you agreed to do this. I think you've gone above and beyond in terms of what a guest has done to prepare for an appearance on this show. You listened to an entire course on The Federalist offered for free by Hillsdale College. And as you were doing it, before I even thought of having you on, you were telling me about the very first lecture of it, and you were saying, well, just off the top of my head, there were five errors in this thing. So I thought, all right, let's have Kevin on to talk about the course. And I guess in the back of my mind, I just figured somehow you could skim through or whatever, but you listen to this thing, and it turns out that, of course, it's not going to get everything wrong, but it has a bias running through it that is typical of the Straussians who dominate Hillsdale College. Now, for the sake of people who have started listening to the show in the past 6 months, why don't we start off by telling them who Straussians are and what their particular take on the Constitution might be so that we can spot when they're up to no good in a course on the Federalist.
Well, I'll be happy to do that, but let me just make a minor correction. I actually identified five factual errors in the first 3 minutes of the first lecture.
Oh, was that what it was?
Right.
Okay. I apologize for that. Okay.
Right. But in general, the Straussians, particularly what are called the West Coast Straussians, are people who are mainly political science scholars who have a very odd, or I should say a very unusual understanding of the American constitutional history. And that understanding is that more or less that the U.S. Constitution was the next thing to divinely inspired. Some of them actually I have heard say that it was divinely inspired. And that there was this wonderful assemblage of unexampled, gigantic figures in world political science who all happened to be Americans in and immediately after the Revolution, who were part of writing and adopting the U.S. Constitution. And so one's understanding of the way government ought to work here and elsewhere in the world, in some cases they say, can be most perfectly fulfilled by focus on the Federalists, uppercase F Federalists, of the 1770s and 80s. And of course, this way of understanding the founding of the country, or the founding of at least the federal system in the United States, is heavily influenced by speeches made by Abraham Lincoln in the 1840s, 50s, and 60s. So when Lincoln said that the Declaration of Independence was the inspiration of the Constitution, that the Union antedated the Declaration of Independence, that the Union was immortal, that, you know, various of these political postulates that were laid out by Lincoln. One is to take these all as just statements of facts, as if he were the supreme authority in physics telling you how matter works. And I think that this approach is heavily dominant in the Hillsdale College online class on the Federalist Papers. And by the way, this certainly is the most preparation I've ever done for any of the hundreds of radio and podcast broadcasts I've been involved in.
I don't know what. You didn't ask for money. You didn't ask for anything. So, I mean, you got me right where you want me at this point. I can't imagine what the favor is going to be someday I'm going to have to do.
Oh, I don't know. It was interesting. I'll put it that way. It was interesting.
All right. So I know they also have a course on the Constitution. I'll have somebody else do that one, Kevin. I won't make you do that. But let's talk about this course on the Federalist in more detail. Just give us the background. Apparently you have five lecturers. You have a number of lectures. You have a quiz at the end. Just give us the absolute basics of that. And then let's start with their view of the situation that prevailed on the eve of the Philadelphia Convention.
Okay, well, the lecturers are Larry Arne, who's the president of Hillsdale College, Matt Spaulding, who has formerly been the eminence of the constitutional scholarship effort at the Heritage Foundation and now holds a high position at Hillsdale College, Paul Ray, obviously. He's a very outstanding American historian who actually is a classicist who wrote a really great book called Republics Ancient and Modern. I think I'm one of about three people who've read every page of that, and he gives a couple of these lectures. They're very high-quality lectures, actually.
I like him, yeah. So that's good to hear.
Yeah, Paul Moreno, who's a constitutional scholar there. Will Morrissey, also a constitutional scholar there in their government department. I have a feeling I'm omitting someone. Maybe I haven't. I guess that's everybody. So the way that the course is set up is it begins with Larry Arne setting the scene in the first lecture, and then it has lectures on what's called the improved science of politics. Anybody who's familiar with the Federalist or with Hamilton or Madison will recognize that phrase from the Federalist, the improved science of politics. Paul Ray's lecture on new discoveries in political science that underlay the arguments made in the Federalist Papers. Then Paul Moreno gives a lecture, The Problem of Majority Faction. And again, if you're familiar with the Federalist, you'll see that the title is a problem, The Problem of Majority Faction, because Madison's famous essay on faction isn't only about majority faction. There's one on federalism and republicanism. And then finally, separation of powers. Before you get to the lectures that are actually on the specific parts of the federal government. Lecture 6 is on the legislature, House and Senate. Lecture 7 is on the executive. Lecture 8 is on the judiciary. And then Lecture 9, which is kind of peculiar, is entitled The Constitution Is Itself a Bill of Rights. And of course, this is an echo of what most people take to be the very weakest part of the Federalist, which is the section of a couple essays where Hamilton is answering the anti-Federalist insistence that there needs to be a Bill of Rights. And finally, there's a concluding lecture, again by Arne, called Constitutionalism Today. So by the time you get through it, at least in theory, you've got the historical background, you've got the several of the key concepts, you've got then individual lectures taking up each of the branches of the federal government, and then a lecture saying why there doesn't need to be a Bill of Rights, before you have a concluding lecture giving you a kind of summary not only of the Federalist but of the current American political scene.
All right, actually, before we go into it, let me change my question. I'm curious to know about the five errors in the first 3 minutes. I think even though that's not as deep as what we'll get into later, it says something that there were five errors in the first 3 minutes. Do you recall these?
Well, actually, I happen to have prepared for this discussion by writing these things down. I took notes as if I were a student in a classroom. I guess that's what they intend for you to do. And Larry Arnn's lecture number one is 33 minutes and 4 seconds long. And I've written down 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11, 12, 13, 14 errors. So 14 indisputable mistakes, such as in those first 3 minutes, saying that Alexander Hamilton was born in Jamaica. Well, he wasn't. He was born in Nevis. Saying that Hamilton and Madison, quote, wrote the Constitution more than any other two people. Well, that's just incorrect. Hamilton, basically, after a few weeks in the Philadelphia Convention, he left town for a month. When he got back, since the other two delegates from New York had already departed, he didn't have a vote in the Philadelphia Convention. He basically sat there quietly, and finally, at the very end of the convention, he made a speech where – well, back up. He had made a long speech on June 18, 1787, where he explained that he'd like a president for life, to appoint senators for life, and to appoint the governors. And finally, at the end of the convention, he said – as you all know, there's nobody whose views are more at variance with this Constitution than mine are. So it was not his idea. It was not anyone else's idea. And he wanted it to be clear that it shouldn't be anyone's idea, that he was one of the chief authors of the Constitution. In fact, he didn't like it. At one point, he said to somebody, well, it's more of pork with a different sauce. You know, it's kind of just Articles of Confederation again. Arnn says, quote, the Federalist Papers are testimony to how much they liked it when it was finished. Well, again, they didn't. In fact, not only did Hamilton not like it, but in my book, James Madison and the Making of America, I show that as soon as he had opportunity, Madison sent a very long letter, the longest letter in their extensive correspondence of many decades, to his friend Thomas Jefferson in France, explaining why he thought this Constitution was going to fail within a few years, even if it were ratified. So the idea that the two of them cooperated in the Federalist because it was testimony to how much they liked it when it was finished is just incorrect. So, you know, I could go on and on. But the point is, really, Arnn needed to have written this out, and then he needed an editor who knew the subject. And this is also true of his final essay. Now, fortunately, the 8 essays that weren't given by President Arnn were far less apt to be full of major and minor mistakes this way. But there were significant errors in most of the lectures. And so if you were somebody who was thinking, well, I'd like to know all about the Federalist, what I'm going to do is I'm going to learn everything they say in this class online, and then I'll know all about the Federalist, that would be a very bad way to learn about the Federalist. I guess that's my ultimate evaluation of this course. Although I'm sympathetic with the aims of these people, and I do agree with them that the government described in the Federalist is better than the one we have now. A lot of the other things they say about it are just mistaken and woefully mistaken.
Kevin, by the way, I didn't have to do a demographic survey for this. I actually have data that comes into me through the podcast host that shows that probably 16-17% of the listeners are outside the United States. And although, you know, this is a very informed audience, let's have you just give a short overview of what the Federalist is when we're talking about the Federalist, or as they became more popularly known in the 20th century, the Federalist Papers. Just for their sake, explain what this is, and then you might simultaneously give your own assessment of the significance of the Federalist, because I know in your own writing you have suggested that most people very much exaggerate the importance of the Federalist in the ratification process.
Well, certainly. The Federalist, or as it's called in this course, the Federalist Papers, that was not the title that its authors gave it, but was a title that it was first given in a popular paperback edition in the 1960s. But the Federalist was a series of newspaper essays and ultimately saying why the U.S. Constitution should be ratified. So what happened was that the two chief authors of the series, there were three authors, one of whom, John Jay, became ill and ended up only contributing 5 of the 85 essays. But the two chief authors of the Federalist were two of the people who had been instrumental in there being a Philadelphia convention in summer of 1787. That is, they were two of the chief movers in the Federalist movement to bring together a convention to propose a new constitution for the United States. And coming out of the convention, it was clear that in New York State, which was the home of one of those two guys, Alexander Hamilton, the political establishment was overwhelmingly opposed to the idea of ratifying this new constitution. And so Hamilton, seeing that the governor was against him, the chief justice, who had been a delegate to the Philadelphia convention with him and then had left early because he was disgusted with what the convention was doing, and other prominent people in New York politics were opposed, Hamilton decided, well, the only thing I can do then to try to bring about ratification in New York is to appeal directly to the voters. And the way to do that would be to write essays for newspapers and tell the voters why this thing should be ratified. And so Hamilton went to another New Yorker, a friend of his from his Columbia College days, Gouverneur Morris, who had been a delegate for Pennsylvania in the convention, and asked him to contribute to this series of newspaper essays he had in mind. Morris said, no, I don't write for newspapers. So then Hamilton went to another friend, William Duer, who did agree and gave Hamilton some essays, which Hamilton decided weren't up to the level of argumentation he was looking for, and so they were not included in the series. Then he lit on the idea of asking James Madison, who, though not a New Yorker, had the special merit of being in New York at the time. That is, after the Philadelphia Convention, Madison had gone back to New York City to resume his service in Congress, which was then meeting in New York. So the two of them chiefly, because as I said, Jay got sick after writing four essays out of the first five in the series and ended up only writing five total. So the two of them, Madison and Hamilton, put together this very articulate, erudite, more or less coherent series of lengthy newspaper essays saying why the Constitution should be ratified. Now, it's true that nowadays it's very common for high school teachers and introductory college government course teachers and so on to say, well, we're going to study the Federalists so that you'll understand what the Constitution was about. But as you mentioned, the Constitution was not ratified because people were persuaded by the Federalists. In fact, by the time the last of those essays appeared, when the series was put in book form, eight states had already ratified. There were states where none of the essays were ever republished. There was no other state than New York in which every one of the Federalist essays was published. And we don't have any evidence that anybody in particular was persuaded to vote to ratify the Constitution by the Federalist. So what's the usefulness of this? I think the chief value of this book is just that it's a very well-constructed defense of the Constitution. Now, the reason it's come to be more important in American history than that is that soon after the constitutional system was implemented in 1789, within a few years, the Supreme Court was adopting the habit of citing the Federalist in its opinions. So it ended up being the case, certainly it's the case now, that one hears people disputing political and constitutional issues by making reference to what Hamilton or Madison or Jay said in the Federalist. And there's never really any discussion of the question, well, why do we care what Alexander Hamilton said in the Federalist? It didn't affect the process of adopting the document. Outside the United States, actually, there has been growing attention to this series. I received my PhD in American history from the University of Virginia in 1999, and while I was there, I had a classmate studying actually with my PhD advisor named Csaba Levy. He was a Hungarian scholar, and after he finished his work at UVA, he went back to Hungary and produced the first ever Hungarian translation of the Federalist, which I understand has now become the topic of significant discussion in Hungary. There have been significant English scholars of the Federalist and French scholars of the Federalist and so on. What it's really useful for, I think, is helping to think about the questions how one might keep an energetic government from becoming too powerful. But we should note that when countries outside the United States, when people in countries outside the United States have had the opportunity to adopt new models of government, they have tended to adopt something more like the British model, where they've adopted something like the American model with strong president instead of something more along parliamentary lines. They've tended to run into difficulties and in many cases ended up with strongmen in the end of their constitutional system. So there's actually a recent book by Frank Buckley, a law professor at George Mason, to the effect that parliamentary systems like the British or the Canadian, the Australian, have been more conducive to long-term liberal society than presidential systems like the American one. But anyway, the bottom line is people do talk about the Federalist a lot. It does inform the way that people think about the U.S. Constitution, even though arguably it shouldn't. And that's why it's worth thinking about.
All right. So let's go back now to what I want to begin with, which is how do they assess the situation that was faced at the time of the Philadelphia Convention? I mean, the conventional wisdom we all know, because every schoolboy gets it, that the Articles of Confederation was an obvious failure. And we could see that from the fact that the certainly the economy was poor, and there was a reluctance on the alleged reluctance on the part of the states to contribute their so-called fair share to the central government, and so on and so forth. Is that basically the view that you get from this course, and is there anything wrong with that view?
Well, one of the dubious statements in Arne's first lecture, which is not among the errors I referred to before, but is just dubious, is when he says that Madison's Vices of the Political System of the United States is the best source on the Articles of Confederation. So essentially you have from the beginning that we're going to take James Madison's word for what the political and economic system of the United States under the Articles of Confederation had led to, or another way of putting it is how well the Articles of Confederation had worked. So essentially there's never a point in this class when in this course when people are told this is what the Federalists said, but other people had another idea. You know, it was actually very common for people who were opposed to ratifying the Constitution without first amending it, and that's really what the so-called anti-Federalists were for, was amending it before they ratified it. There is no point at which the contrary argument is presented in this course. So you don't have Richard Henry Lee saying, well, yes, we have significant government debt, but that's because we just won a war against the greatest military power in the world, and this isn't going to be a recurring phenomenon. We don't have to surrender a lot of power to a central government because we're going to have periodic wars with the British. George Mason said similar things. Yes, we have significant debt, but we'll pay it off. It's not that we need to rush into granting significant new power to this government without a Bill of Rights, without sufficient checks on the president, without clear enough demarcation of the jurisdiction of the courts, and so on. So that was the contrary argument. There actually was, I guess it's about 10 years ago now, an interesting book by a political scientist, I think, published by Oxford. Maybe it was Cambridge, anyway, showing that if you take a rational choice approach to the behavior of state governments during and after the Revolution, they actually contributed more money to the Confederation government than you would have expected. So the Federalist case that the Articles of Confederation were just too weak and there needed to be more power in the central government is one over which one could argue. I actually tend to come down on the side of there needed to be a taxing power in the central government, whether it was one with a new frame or not. There needed to be at least amendment to the Articles of Confederation to allow the Confederation government to tax. But again, there's just no indication in this course that that was even a matter of dispute.
Now, when the course talks about the structure of the proposed government, the different branches and so on and so forth, I would assume that it gets this technical stuff more or less correct. So unless I'm wrong about that, of course, but where does it go wrong? Does it go wrong in exaggerating the significance of the Federalist? After the errors of Larry Arnn, are the errors here more in the cheerleading for the Federalist, or where are they?
Well, it certainly is common to exaggerate the significance of the Federalist and to assume that everything the Federalist says is accurate. One kind of problem that makes an appearance over and over is just accepting the Federalist's forecast about the way the U.S. Constitution will work without pointing out that it didn't work out that way, you know, that the evaluation that's being made by Madison in particular about the for example, if you take the lecture on the problem, quote unquote, the problem of majority faction, okay, that's, of course, on the general subject of Federalist number 10, the most famous of the Federalist essays. First of all, Paul Moreno, a constitutional historian who gives this lecture, says that Publius defines faction as a group that's willing, quote, to trample on the rights of minority groups or of individuals. Well, that's not accurate. Madison actually defines a faction as any group, and he expressly says it could be a majority or minority who have leagued together to seek their own interests instead of the common interests or rights of society. Madison also assumes that the problem of minority faction is easily resolved in a Republican system. You just vote them down. But Moreno omits, and this is something that political scientists can't help but notice, that we have now political parties, which one can certainly describe, at least the Democratic Party. I guess you could make a similar argument about the Republican Party, although it isn't so obvious. But one could easily describe the Democratic Party as just a league of minority factions. It's not obvious that, you know, the constituency for the Department of Housing and Urban Development has anything much in common with the upper middle class white women who, support abortion rights, and yet they vote together consistently. Why? Well, because they're minority factions who, realizing that if they league together, they can have their way over time, have done so. So the failure to foresee that there would be parties has led to the thwarting of the project that people like Madison had in mind in creating this extended republic. And Moreno doesn't deal with that. He doesn't say, well, Madison was mistaken because there are parties or anything like that. Actually, later on in the course, when we get to, what is it, Lecture 8, I think, where they where the subject is the judiciary, Hamilton says in one of the latest of the Federalist essays that one remedy, provision of the Constitution that will prevent usurpation by the judiciary is impeachment. And then the lecturer says, well, we haven't had very many judicial impeachments. And actually, we've only had one judicial impeachment for usurpation. And in that case, Justice Chase was acquitted, even though he clearly had committed usurpation. So this check has proven totally ineffective for the purpose for which Hamilton was calling it to mind. And again, the lecturer doesn't say, well, this is a way in which the Federalists proved to be entirely mistaken. So I'm not saying, I don't want to be understood as saying that the Federalist is not a brilliant book. It is. It's about as good a defense of a not yet implemented constitution as one could hope for. Clearly, both Hamilton and Madison were possessed of intellect and knowledge that are far beyond those of common people. But they were mistaken in several significant ways, and you wouldn't get that from this course.
Does the course actually endorse their view of the view that there's no need for a Bill of Rights because if the Constitution doesn't authorize something in the first place, for example, abridgment of the freedom of speech, then there'd be no need to protect against that because it's not authorized in the first place. And if you do protect against it, then you're implying that the federal government really has all powers that aren't expressly withheld from it, and that would be a dangerous situation. So it's best just not to have a Bill of Rights. I know, because I know you, I know what your answer is to that. But first of all, tell us what your answer is to that. And secondly, do they actually adopt this in the course, or do they just give it a sympathetic hearing?
Well, actually, they go further than that. It's Will Morrissey who's giving this lecture, and he actually, along with Paul Ray, I would say is one of the two best of the five lecturers. He does a really good job in the lectures he presents. But essentially what he does in this lecture is simply to repeat Hamilton's argument, which is more or less the same as the argument made by James Wilson. He doesn't mention Wilson. Okay, just a little bit of explanation. James Wilson of Pennsylvania was one of the chief authors of the Constitution, unlike Hamilton. He was a member of the Philadelphia Convention who had his finger on a lot of provisions of the Constitution. And then shortly after the convention ended on September 17, 1787, I think 10 days later, very shortly after anyway, Wilson went to the Pennsylvania State House in downtown Philadelphia, which was the biggest city in America at the time, and presented a speech which became known as Wilson's State House Speech. This speech, unlike the Federalist, was reprinted in every state. It was discussed in several of the ratification conventions, and it had Wilson saying, among other things, well, we don't need a Bill of Rights because this new government, unlike a state government, is going to have only the powers we expressly give it. Now, a state government can be assumed to have all powers unless there's something in a state constitution saying that it doesn't have them, but the federal government is going to be organized on the opposite principle. So Morrissey doesn't mention Wilson here. He doesn't say this is Wilson's argument. Now, he does something different from that. The one bit of data to bear in mind, and as I tell you what Morrissey does about this, is that I think the outstanding Hamiltonian historian of the last century was a University of Alabama history professor named Forrest MacDonald. And MacDonald took a special pleasure in being a Hamiltonian in what is a Jeffersonian or further left historical profession in the United States. So he, a few years back, he published a book that was a collection of his articles. One of them was about the idea that Hamilton had been right, that America would have had more rights, would have been better off if there hadn't been a Bill of Rights. Okay. So what Morrissey does, though, in his lecture is to say that Hamilton changed his mind and decided that a Bill of Rights was necessary. I know of no evidence for that. Right. I don't know what he's talking about in saying that. Certainly Forrest MacDonald, who I think is the leading expert on Hamilton in our lifetimes, he doesn't think that Hamilton changed his mind. So how do we explain this? Well, I think there's a general tendency among the Straussians to want to make these guys palatable in our day. I mean, I guess the most egregious illustration of this claim is a book by another Hillsdale professor named Thomas West, who's not a participant.
Oh.
Yeah, West is not a participant in this course, but he wrote a book, I guess 15 or 20 years ago now, called Vindicating the Founders.
Horrible.
Yeah, what he attempted to do was to show that feminists and civil rights advocates and other such people in America were wrong in criticizing the founding fathers, because really the founding fathers were all feminists and civil rights advocates and, you know, various kinds of left wingers too. So apparently that's the impulse that's driving Morrissey here. Well, if we've decided the Bill of Rights is a good thing, surely Hamilton must have been for it. I don't think we have him saying it, and certainly Forrest MacDonald doesn't think Hamilton later changed his mind about having a Bill of Rights. And in fact, Hamilton ultimately endorsed the Sedition Act of 1798. He had not been for it in the first place, but once it was adopted, he thought it should be enforced. So I just, you know, why am I picking on this particular point? Because I think it illustrates the general tendency among these people. I don't class Paul Ray among them, but in general, the Straussians want to make these guys the saints of the secular church of Federalist constitutionalism and Lincolnian loving. So that's that's how I explain this, what I think is an error in lecture number 9 of saying that Hamilton changed his mind.
And I think your take on the Bill of Rights question in terms of this whole dispute as to whether a Bill of Rights might actually be dangerous, because if you say we prohibit Congress from doing the following things when the Congress was never given the authority to do those things in the first place, then you're implying that the federal government has a whole raft of powers that are not expressly enumerated. Your response, I think, more or less has been, well, I can't imagine that if government wants to do something, that this is going to that simply clarifying what our rights are is really going to be the thing that makes the government become absolute. I mean, something like that.
Right. Well, there was an argument that if we had adopted a constitution that did not expressly grant Congress power to create a national church, and then we came back later and adopted an amendment that said Congress doesn't have power to create a national church, then the implication would be that somewhere in the unamended Constitution there had been language that you could read as empowering Congress to create a national church. And the only and of course this would be conducive to taking a, shall we say, a broad-minded or I guess a Hamiltonian approach to construing the rest of the Constitution. The way to avoid that was to refrain from adopting the amendment banning a national church. Well, Hamiltonian reading of the Constitution was going to be tried at some point by someone. And so as far as I'm concerned, people like John Taylor were right in saying there should have been more amendments. There should have been amendments at every step of the way. Anytime the federal government did something that was unconstitutional, the next time Congress met, it should have adopted an amendment saying Congress, you know, the executive can't do this. Or the next time an election threw out the congressional majority, the new majority should have sent out an amendment saying Congress can't do that. But instead, we've adopted the posture of saying, well, this is such a perfect system that doesn't work the way we want. We're never going to change it so it'll work the way it should. I think it's nonsensical, but it's related to this founder's worship that you find in these people. You know, and the thing is, these people themselves did not believe that the Constitution should be unamendable. They didn't think it was perfect. And as I mentioned before, Madison himself was very unhappy with it. Hamilton said in the Philadelphia Convention, as I said before, that he was unhappy with it. And Madison wrote at length about being unhappy with it. All the way to the end of his life, he didn't want people calling him the father of the Constitution because, well, he hadn't liked it. So he wanted to blame it partly on other people. He said it was the work of many hands and many heads, which is fair.
Kevin, there's an elephant in the room here that I might as well just point out to everybody. We might as well just say it. Of course, we're criticizing another course when you have your own course on the Constitution, right? You and Brian McClanahan, you have a course on the American Revolution and on U.S. history at mylibertyclassroom.com website. So we might as well just be totally open about that we do have a competing product. And so we should be as upfront about that as possible. I don't care because, I mean, look, I'm giving away a free show 5 days a week. I don't care if I promote my site once in a while. But really, in particular, it's that Hillsdale, because it has a gigantic mailing list, it's gotten tremendously influential, is going to lead people into error. I mean, that we are genuinely concerned about this. Like, you and I could both be earning a lot more money than we do now if we were in other lines of work, but we do care about this. I mean, yes, we earn money from libertyclassroom.com. That is true. But we could earn a heck of a lot more doing a million other things or saying what the establishment wants us to say, and yet we don't do that. So we're not entirely just trying to take people's dough when we talk about this. These are real important things that matter to you and me. But maybe it might be fitting for you to close by talking about what a good course on the Federalist and, by extension, a good course on the Constitution would look like, given that you yourself created one.
Well, I don't think there should be a course on the Federalist. I think that constitutional history has to have, or a class in constitutional history has to have some attention to the Federalist. But just to say to people, well, if you want to understand the Constitution, you should take our course in constitutional history and our course on the Federalist, is itself to distort and exaggerate the role of the Federalist in constitutional history. So although you've rightly said, well, we have competing product, I'd say not exactly. We don't have a class on the Federalist, and I don't propose teaching one because I...
Well, good, because I wasn't going to ask, so it works out great.
Because I don't think that people should start to study the Constitution or American constitutional history by reading the Federalist. That's just not the way to approach it. As I said before, Larry Arnn starts by saying these two chief authors of this book are the two guys who are most responsible for the way the Constitution was written. That's just mistaken. That's untrue. And both of them, Hamilton himself said so. You know, here he is in a room with 38 people, and he says nobody here's got views of these matters that are further from this Constitution than mine are known to be. How you could go from that to this is one of the two main authors of the Constitution, I don't know. So I think that American constitutional history should start with antecedents of American constitutionalism in England and before English constitutional history, then should say something about American colonial constitutional history before describing the Revolution, the Articles of Confederation period, and the Philadelphia Convention, followed by the ratification process. So I guess if I had been in the room in Hillsdale when they were deciding to offer this course, I would have said, no, I don't think we should have a class on the Federalist. I think we should have a class on the ratification process generally. Yes, the Federalist will be featured. It won't be the chief thing because it wasn't that important. You know, they're actually Liberty Fund, which is an outstanding alienomissionary institution in Indiana, publishes very inexpensive hardback and paperback editions of classic books about liberty, including The Federalist. They have a very good edition of The Federalist with an introductory essay by Jim McClellan and George Carey. And in the introductory essay of the Liberty Fund edition of The Federalist by Jim McClellan and George Carey, those two very fine scholars say The Federalist had no effect on the ratification process.
And I love those guys.
Right.
McClellan was great, and Carey too.
Right. Well, I can mention my favorite book on the Federalist is by Albert Furtwängler, who was a political scientist who used to be at Cornell. And his book is called The Authority of Publius, and he basically shows the same thing. And I have spent a lot of time myself in the primary materials about the ratification process in Virginia, and there's no influence of the Federalist on the ratification process in Virginia. So it's just, as I say, it's misleading to have a class on the Federalist if you aren't telling people, first, you should understand that this is something that was produced during the ratification process over which it didn't have any demonstrable influence. But we're going to read it as we would read a book by Plato, not that we think Plato affected, you know, Philip of Macedon or anybody politically important at the time. But we think Plato's books are inherently interesting. They ask important questions and they give interesting answers. That's the way I would approach the Federalist if I were going to do it at all. And I guess that's my criticism of, well, political science as a field, maybe, but certainly of the Straussian Hillsdale approach to these matters.
Well, Kevin, we're going to leave it off there, and I will link to the course on the show notes page for today, which would be tomwoods.com/411, and to related episodes. I had Frank Buckley on the show. You mentioned him earlier. And, of course, we'll link to kevingutzman.com, to your books, James Madison and the Making of America being a very important one, but all your books. I think people should read The Politically Incorrect Guide to the Constitution. And, of course, they should read Who Killed the Constitution by a certain couple of gentlemen. But Kevin, I don't even know. I'm embarrassed you did so much work here. You know, so next time, you know, feel free to come on drunk if you want. Like, really take it easy next time to compensate for everything you did this time for us. It was a very important service. Thanks a lot.
Well, you know, now that you've asked me to come on drunk, I guess the alcohol will be a tax deduction. Wonderful.
Yeah, that's right. Well, and you know, I've always thought it would be fun to do an episode drunk, you know, just to see. You can always, there's a delete key for a reason, right? You know, just... All right. Thanks again, Kevin.
You're welcome.
All right, everybody. I hope you enjoyed that chat with Kevin Gutzman. Take a big chunk off your subscription to Liberty Classroom. Of course, you get all the courses when you sign up. It's not one course at a time. You get everything we have when you sign up, and you can take a big chunk of that off with discount code SHOW in all caps. That's to thank all you good listeners of the show over at libertyclassroom.com. I produce a new episode Monday through Friday. So if you really want to accelerate your education in Liberty, you'll subscribe for free on iTunes or Stitcher using the links you'll find over at tomwoods.com. Thanks for listening, everybody. We'll see you tomorrow.
The Tom Woods Show.